status quo. And this is a chapter, creation of the universal form. It has another 11 verses until the end. So we are just after the middle of the chapter. So this discussion is here because the Bhagavatam is preparing us to understand the vastness or the greatness of the Supreme Source, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Before I start, there is a verse that is the second last verse of this chapter. It says, "The wonderful potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is bewildering even to the jugglers. That potential power is unknown even to the self-sufficient Lord, so it is certainly unknown to others." This is just gives us a glimpse into the unlimited potency that is there within the Supreme Conscious Being. The last verse is, "Words, mind and ego, with their respective controlling demigods, have failed to achieve success in knowing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, we simply have to offer our respectful obeisances unto Him as a matter of sanity." So, if someone wants to be sane, he has to offer obeisances to the Supreme Being. And then in that offering of obeisances, hopefully one will understand something about our position in this world. So this is the idea of this chapter. So let us read the verse today, 29. Please kindly repeat responsibly. Tartiyena swabhavena,
Tartiyena swabhavena,
Bhagavan navimashrita,
Bhagavan navimashrita,
Ubayur antaram vyoma,
Ubayur antaram vyoma,
Ye rudra parshadam gana,
Ye rudra parshadam
gana. Word by word translation. Tartiyena, by excessive development of the third mode of material nature, the mode of ignorance, Svabhavena,
by such nature,
Bhagavat Nabhim,
the
abdominal navel of the gigantic form, the abdominal navel of the gigantic form of the Personality of Godhead. Ashrita, those who are so situated, Ubayo, between the two, Antaram, in between, Vyoma, the sky. Yeah. All of whom? Rudra Parshadam, associates of Rudra, Gana, population. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace is compounder Acharya Abhay Charanaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. Living entities who are associates of Rudra develop in the third mode of material nature or ignorance. They are situated in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The middle portion of the sky is called Bhuvarloka, as confirmed by both Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti and Srila Jiva Goswami. In Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that those who develop in the mode of passion are situated in the middle region. Those who are situated in the mode of goodness are promoted to the regions of the demigods. Those who are situated in the mode of passion are placed in human society. And those who are situated in the mode of ignorance are placed in the society of animals or ghosts. There are no contradictions in this conclusion. Numerous living entities are distributed all over the universe in different planets and are so situated in terms of their own qualities in the modes of material nature. Om Agenati Mirandasya Agenatana Shalakaya Chakshur Milita Mena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Ena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadam Ayam Dadati Svapadantikam He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpa Turuvishcha Kripa Sindhu Mevacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So dear devotees, we are reading this interesting text 29 of Creation of the Universal Form. So, in Bhagavad Gita, this is a whole chapter, chapter 11, dedicated to the universal form, where Arjuna requests Krishna to show him the universal form, and Krishna shows him the universal form, and Arjuna is faced with a very ghastly and scary picture. He sees so many different faces, arms and legs unlimitedly spread, and he sees some of the faces, some fire is coming out, and he sees time, and he sees how the Kauravas, his cousins on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, basically entering into the mouth of time and becoming destroyed. So, then that frightens Arjuna. And Arjuna requests Krishna, "My dear Lord, please kindly, this is very shocking and scary form. Can you kindly please show me your forearmed form?" He's requesting Krishna to show these aspects of himself for the sake of protecting what is real, what God can do, what is the reality about God, because Arjuna knew that many people will claim to be God in the future. So he wanted Krishna to show this universal form, which is unlimited to our comprehension. And in that way he could preserve the understanding that if someone, this is kind of the standard, if someone is claiming that is God, he should show the universal form. If someone says you are not advanced enough to be able to see the universal form, then you can say that Arjuna asked Krishna, to give him divine eyes to be able to see. So give me divine eyes. I may not be advanced, but should give me divine eyes to see it. I remember in the 70s, Jimi Hendrix produced an album, and his artists for the album, they took Vishnu's head and they put Jimi Hendrix's head on the album with the universal form, and that was his album actually. So people will speculate, they will do all kind of crazy things. It's like Jimi Hendrix is God or something. So this is the idea. Arjuna requested Krishna to show him this universal form. And the universal form actually indicates that behind everything there is a personality. For example, the sun is a person. The wind is a person. The rain is a person. The source of all these energies. Mother Earth, Bhumi, is a person. All the planets, a person. There is a person in charge of that planet. And in fact, the planet is represented by a person. So we may not understand how this works. But at least to me, I don't know about you, it makes sense to me. Because I understand there is multidimensional reality. And there is another dimension that we cannot observe. So there is a living entity that is actually Bhumi. She is Earth personified. And the Earth is one aspect of Bhumi, and we can see that aspect. But we don't really understand Bhumi, who she is. Just like the microbes on our skin, they eat him. They think this is everything, but actually they don't understand you are a soul in charge of that body. So they cannot see what is going on. So in the same way, we're just like a microbe on this planet. We don't really understand what is going on. That's powerful, huh? So everything is like that. Behind every energy, there is a personality. And this is Vaishnavism. This is the message of Bhagavatam. So this universal form is exactly like that. All these devatas became visible to Arjuna. All these entities that are behind the external vision of some blue sky, some sun is there, some stars and planets are in the sky. This is just an external vision of what's actually going on. But Arjuna saw behind, because he was given this spiritual vision, divine eyes, and he saw the entities behind the external creation. So this is actually the universal form of the Lord. And it's really horrible. Arjuna became afraid. He said, Krishna, please, I've had enough of watching this. Can you kindly show me your forearm form? If you are God, can you kindly show me? So then Krishna showed him the form of Narayan with four arms. And we can't imagine how it looks, because for us, we have only experience of two arms. So someone with four arms may look like almost like a deformity or something like that. Like this King Paundraka, he put four arms. He put two artificial arms and he said, I am Vishnu. You remember that story in Krishna book? There was some rascal, you know, Paundraka. He dressed like Krishna. And he put two artificial arms and he looked like a clown, you know. And he went and he told Krishna, I am Krishna. You are a rascal. You should immediately submit unto me. Surrender. So it was some crazy guy, you know. But it's part of Krishna's lila. So he must have been a very great soul to be acting, teaching this lesson to all of us. So don't think when you read descriptions like this that this is some weird Hindu mythology, four-armed forms, universal form. What is this bogus things, you know? I cannot see anything of this. Why should I believe it? You know, this is a conception in the material world. Seeing is believing. Hard facts and hard data. But Bhagavatam actually is saying that in order for us to see and understand these things, we need to apply ourselves to the process of bhakti. And that process will give us the internal vision, the divine vision, to be able to see all these different aspects that are currently unavailable to our gross senses. So, if the modern scientists or logicians, they want to understand the universal form, whether it really exists, they shouldn't rely on their blunt senses as the only way of discovering truth. Because, as we know, our senses are already defective. So, in our tradition, we accept logic and sense perception as secondary tools for acquiring truth. The first tool is Shabda Brahman. You hear from an authority. And then logic and sense perception helps you to kind of examine their point of view, that authority. And then there will be certainly indications in this world which you can see through your senses that could satisfy your logical thinking. And that could make you convinced that whatever has been said or proposed or explained in the scripture or by the spiritual master is actually real. Like there is this saying, as above, so below. So, we understand from scripture, for example, that the Supreme Lord has a feminine and a masculine aspect. Radha, Krishna, Lakshmi, Narayan. So in this way, we observe with our senses and we see in this world there is everywhere. The living entities have a feminine and a masculine aspect. So that means the source also must have. So we may not be able to see directly, but it's logical. Because with the eyes, we see that there is man and woman everywhere. There is a feminine and masculine in all living entities. So the original living entity also must have that aspect. Otherwise, where would the other aspect come from? Sometimes we have this idea, God is only male. But if God was only male, where is the female coming from? You see? And if God is like some feminists are saying, God is female, you know, where is the male coming from? So the supreme source must be both. There is a word for it, androgynous. So we know Radha and Krishna are one, but they eternally separated to share a loving pastime. So you cannot say Radharani is not God. She is an aspect of Krishna. This we don't remember and we don't understand sometimes these things. But again, the point I'm making is when you hear Shastra explaining this, you use your senses. Yeah, there is man and woman in this world. So if the source, if this world represents the source, then the source also must be, it is accurate that the Bhagavatam is speaking about Lakshmi Narayan and Radha Krishna. You know, of course, Radharani is not directly mentioned in Bhagavatam, but Chaitanya Charitamrita. So in this way, Shabda Brahman can be verified through sense perception and logic. Do you understand my point? Yeah? So, yes, we use our senses and our logic, but they are subservient to Shabda Brahman. You see, this is how our science operates. And this is still in the realm of beginning stages of devotional service. And then this is called Gyan. I think I explained last time I spoke. And then when you practice Bhakti Mama Vijanati Avam Yashchasmi Tatvataha Tatumam Tatvata Getva Vishate Tadanataram. When you practice the process of Bhakti, then this Gyan becomes Vigyan. Then you start to see Radha and Krishna, Lakshmi, Narayan. You start to see everything. You develop an internal vision. You're no longer blind believer. You're actually seeing the activities of the Lord, eternal, sat, asta kaliya lila. The Lord is constantly engaged in activities. So, if people criticize us, you're just sentimental believers, you're just anti-intellectual fools. You know, anti-intellectual means someone who can't think, he just believes something. Then you can tell them that actually this process, I may be telling you something that is behind my experience right now, but the process leads to the experience, direct experience. So Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj once was giving a class and he said, how should you decide whether to join an institution or not, or spiritual path? He said, I'm sorry, you have to study what's the goal, what's the objective. If you follow this path, what will happen to you? What's the ultimate aim? If you're satisfied with that, then you should study who has achieved it in the past. And then the third question is, who is achieving it now? Are there any people who are achieving it now? Or we only speak, you know, Rupa Goswami did, Sanatana Goswami did. But now there is nobody, unfortunately. But one day we will have some. So if these three things are in tune, then you can join such an organization. It means it's functional. So again, what's the aim and objective? If you are satisfied with the aim and objective, what is the aim and objective? To become pure lover of God. Are you happy? Yes, I am happy. Some people's aim and objective is to merge into oneness. Are you happy with this? It's not for me. Thank you. I don't want to join this movement. So you have to know the objective of the movement. A lot of people are joining movements, religious institutions or something like that, but they don't know what's the aim. They discover after a long time that this is what is going to happen to me. And then, you know. But now they are already married with kids in the movement. They can't, the husband is like this, they can't leave, or the wife. I've seen people like that. Sentimentally joining something without understanding what's the aim. Of course, this is, in ISKCON it's not like that, because Prabhupada's books are so clear. Even if you read one small book, you'll understand what's the aim and objective. But then the second point is, who has achieved it in the past? Are there any personalities who actually saw this Asta Kaliya Lila? Who saw the internal, transcendental divine activities of the Lord while He was not present on earth? So we read the biography of the Goswamis and we see Rupa Goswami once in meditation, he saw some lila unfolding and he was laughing. And then one devotee who had some, he was lame or something like that, he was passing and he thought that Rupa Goswami is laughing at him and he took offense. You've heard that story? Took offense and then Rupa Goswami's meditation broke. He couldn't see the Lord anymore. And then later on, his brother inquired, why you are like that? So he said, well, I was laughing and suddenly it just stopped. So he said, you must have committed an offense. Do you remember? Did you offend someone? Rupa Goswami said, no, I don't remember offending anyone. So So Sanatana Goswami told him, okay, you set up a feast for all the Vaishnavas in Vrindavan and invite everyone. If someone doesn't come, that means you have offended him. So all the Vaishnavas converged, but this devotee that had a deformity, he didn't come. So then he understood there is something. So he went and he spoke to him. And he said, yeah, I came one day in front of your cottage. I was walking there and you started laughing at me. So then Rupa Goswami understood, okay. But he was actually an internal consciousness. He was seeing Krishna, Krishna Lila. Many examples like that. Shyamananda, he found the ring of Radharani or some earring or something. There is a story. And then she put Tilak on his face and she changed his name from Duki Krishna Das to Shyamananda. And then his guru became so angry. How can you change your name? What is this Tilak? He came all the way from Bengal to chastise his disciple because she told him, don't tell anyone. So you may think, oh, this happened to some acharyas in the past. You know. This is the second point. Yes, we have such evidence that some people have achieved seeing the inner divine reality that cannot be seen by ordinary humans. So we've got history recorded. Many of them stories like that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said, I was chanting in my house, suddenly I found myself in Vrindavan. You remember that? It's one of his songs. He's explaining how he was chanting and suddenly he found himself in Vrindavan. So, and then who is achieving it currently? When you look around yourself, are there any devotees who are achieving this very high level of consciousness or are just about to achieve it? Yes, there is many. Look at how many advanced devotees are there in ISKCON. Ahindra Prabhu, for example, he was saying that if someone doesn't meditate on Krishna Lila 24/7, he's in Maya. So we are all in Maya. Maybe some of you are not, but so this was his standard for who is in Maya. Of course, for us, the standard is if you don't chant 16 rounds and follow the four eggs, you are in Maya. But for Indra Prabhu, even if you're doing this and if you're not observing Astakali Lila the whole day, you are in Maya. He was saying like that. That was his consciousness. And of course, there are many devotees that will not say because we don't advertise these things. But you can actually detect the purity of a person. Prabhupada, so many people were attracted to him because of his purity, his consciousness. Even living entities were attracted by Prabhupada. I was reading yesterday by Shruta Kirti Prabhu one story. One cat, he was doing massage for Prabhupada, and one cat entered under the gate, and she went in, small cat, and started rubbing his back on Prabhupada. You know, while Shruta Kirti Prabhu was giving massage. And he said for 2 or 3 minutes Prabhupada didn't react. I was shocked, he said. Prabhupada let that cat to, you know, like rub and be in contact with him, you know. So Prabhupada was not, yeah, this dirty cat, you know, what is this? Like some of us may do probably. He allowed that cat to be in touch with his transcendental body. And after some time he said to Shruta Kirti, okay, take him out now. So he put him out. The cat came 3 times inside. He was so attached to Prabhupada. And then final time, Shruta Kirti Prabhu put something under the door because he was sneaking under the little gap there so that he cannot come. And then he said the cat started to cry outside. You know, this is just one example. Even ordinary living entities, small living entities, are attracted to very advanced sadhus, both in male and female bodies. Not that just male can become sadhu, pure devotee. That is male chauvinism, illusion. There is many examples of great ladies. You can also study, oh, are there any ladies that became pure devotees or only men became? if ladies are not becoming, then what am I doing in this movement? You know? Or maybe you, woman, in next life you'll become brahmachari, then you'll become pure. Some people may think like that. Crazy, you know. No. You study the Shastra, you see Janavi Mata, Ganga Mata Goswamini. In the past, they achieved. In fact, they had disciples. Some king was disciple of Ganga Mata Goswamini. There was another, Krishna Priya Thakurani. One person offended her that she was chanting. Insulted her actually, that she was chanting in his class. He was some great pandit, I can't remember, famous pandit, giving class and she was chanting on beats, you know, in his class. Her, very quiet, her mouth was moving. She was listening to his katha and chanting, and he offended her. Why you don't have respect for me? You're chanting in my class or something. And he offended her in some horrible way, then developed some horrible disease after that. So, these are examples that pure devotees can be in both genders. And definitely we have pure devotees now. Many powerful ladies also in ISKCON, not just male devotees. There are so many of them on the ISKCON Desire Tree. You can hear lectures. Urmila Mataji, Lakshmi Moni Narayan, so many of them, powerful lectures. So these are some indicators that why we should join a movement. You know, are there any people who are achieving it now? And if there are such individuals, they are completely materially unmotivated. They're completely dedicated to serve Krishna, and they're always in bliss. And when you come in contact with them, you also become in bliss. That's an indication that this person is very advanced. Because every time we come in contact with advanced people, we feel very, very happy and reaffirmed, and it gives us faith that this movement works. This is special. It's something important. It's wonderful. This is why association with devotees is very important. So, these strange descriptions to a modern materialistic mind, actually not strange, because they're simply describing the subtle realm, which we do not see. Like I said to you, the microbe is on your skin, eating your skin, living on your skin. But the microbe doesn't understand that you are a soul that is inside this body. Similarly, you are standing on the planet Earth, but you don't understand Bhumi is a person. You don't understand the sun is a person. You only see in the external of everything. You see? So this is the universal form. That's how we understand these things. So, there is always, in this world, there is always a clash between theists and atheists, and a clash between Vaishnavas and impersonalists. Because everyone has a different perception. You know, everyone sees things differently. And this will never come to, this world will never become just fully, everybody will see in a theistic way. There is always people who will not see that way. For example, Bhagavatam explains, during Prahlad Maharaja's time, his father was a demon. Shanda Amarka, this was millions of years ago, great atheist. And that was supposed to be an age of, you know, where there was mostly predominance of theism or religion. But still, you see, there were great atheists even at that time. So there won't be never a moment in this world when there will be only theism. There will be always some opposing arguments and theories and perceptions. So this is normal. But we have to understand theism properly so that we could practice properly, we could teach it properly, and we could help those who are searching. No. And the more we help those who are searching, the more we advance ourselves. This is how it works. There is some philosophy that was believed at some point in human history. It's called deism, with D. D-I-E-S-M, deism. And the early American fathers, they believed in this philosophy. It's like Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, etc., people like that. They believed in deism. Deism means the laws of nature produced by God, but then after he set the material universe in motion, he stopped interacting with it. It's just the laws are operating and that's it. That's deism. They believe like that, that God created the world and then he's not interacting with it anymore. And then there is another philosophy that came a little later called determinism, which was based on these laws. They discovered that the laws that determine, they're the same, repetitively the same, all the time. And basically, it's almost like there is no free will. Everything is set by these laws and everything is in motion under the laws. And, so that was called determinism by the law. The laws are determining what's going on in this world. There is no other aspects. That was also given up. And then the new theory of science is everything happens by chance. Sometimes things occur by chance. So this is like, can be given example of casinos. People want to win by chance, you know. So, but we know that winning by chance is very difficult. In fact, people in casino usually lose. And even if they win, the owners of the casino try to cheat him. So some determinism comes there. That we will determine that he lose at the end. So still that control is there. Even if one wins, still there is control. And then one again loses. So if that chance cannot be the ultimate. It's an occasional chance. If the casino operated simply by the laws of chance, they might have lost sometimes, but they have the law of determinism also. So one example is one person I heard won some money playing in a casino. And then basically because they know that people, when they win, they become greedy. They want to win more. So then he started to play and he was thinking, I'll win more. He lost his whole his bank account and the house. Everything he lost. Yeah. He won some small amount of money, a few hundred dollars. He won and he was thinking, if I play, then I'll win. And then in the course of the playing, within I don't know how long period of time, a few days or a few weeks, I don't know, he lost everything. I don't know what kind of a casino was that, but there's a story who I heard directly from a person working in the casino. He told me, I saw the guy won and then he lost everything within a few weeks. So chance doesn't operate. There is actually control. And some people think that control is created by God and left. And some people think, no, God is interacting. And this is us, actually. We understand that there is a design and the Supreme Person continuously interacts with this material world. He comes as an avatar. He manages. Lord Vishnu is continuously engaged with this material world. And one proof that there is a design and that there is an interaction is that there is the law of thermodynamics, as far as I know. Every order in time turns into chaos. You understand my English? Chaos?
Yeah.
Everything turns into chaos. So every order in time turns into chaos. But we see that in this world, for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years of our human history, we see that everything, you know, the laws operate in the same way. They don't deteriorate. So that indicates a constant order, constant control. So that's how God is always involved in this world. And He comes as an avatar as well. So here in this particular verse, it's explaining about the living entities who are associates of Rudra. They develop the third mode of material nature or ignorance. Rudra principle is the principle of anger sometimes. The false ego, intense false ego. So someone who is very envious, arrogant, angry person, then he becomes an associate of Lord Shiva. In a sense, they become controlled by the mode of ignorance. And Prabhupada draws he is quoting here the Gita in the purport, that in Bhagavad Gita it is stated that one who dies in a mode of goodness promoted to the heavenly planets, one who dies in a mode of passion amongst humans, and one who dies in mode of ignorance in the society of animals or ghosts. So here in this verse it says they are situated in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. So Prabhupada said there is no contradiction, because in Bhagavad Gita it says in the bodies of animals, but here it says in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. So there are other references which are more specific that explain that there is such entities as ghosts and disembodied beings. Usually people who commit suicide become ghosts, a mode of ignorance. And animals, of course, in a mode of ignorance. So this indicates reincarnation, this verse, that there is something, an aspect of us that remains after death, again, which we cannot see with these gross eyes. But the Bhagavatam is indicating, and Bhagavad Gita clearly states, you know, what was that verse? 2:13, how did it go? It's very clear, explained there, that there is an embodied being who continuously passes from different stages in the body, and at the time of death it moves into another body, and there is no confusion for someone who has a spiritual vision, or he is being at least educated into the spiritual paradigm. Even if he has not developed the vision to see the soul, at least he's educated. So he's not confused by such a thing. So here the Bhagavatam explains the process of reincarnation and how the souls can be even placed in different realms. So Patrick was asking me a few days ago about the universe, and he quoted how Prabhupada spoke with some disciple who was arguing with Prabhupada that the earth is round, and then Prabhupada was saying that actually it's flat and it goes on. So, and how do you reconcile this? Because we know from our experience, if you go with the plane through the Pacific Ocean you reach America, and through Europe, if you go the other way, you still reach America. So it shows that it's round. But the answer to this is that there are a three-dimensional explanation of the Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada was speaking about one dimension, and that disciple was speaking about the what we could experience. But Prabhupada was speaking of the dimension of the demigods. Planet Earth is situated on Bhumandala. Bhumandala means the flat disk, which indicates the planetary system, the solar system, Bhumandala. And the different planets are the dvipas, or islands. And that shows that, someone may say, how do the ancients knew about these things? Well, the answer is that they had advanced astronomy even at that time. They understood the sky. I watched this documentary, the Code of the Pyramid, and pyramids. And the scientists think that the pyramids were tombs for the pharaoh's bodies, but actually not all of them think like that. Some scientists actually discovered that these pyramids, or most of them, some of them were used as tombs, but not all of them. They didn't find any remains of human beings being buried under in most of the pyramids. So they were used as astronomy bases. They could actually detect the motion of the sky. You know, the sky moves, you know, so in different, I'm not very good with astronomy, but at different time of the year, you can see different set of stars above your head, and it moves like that. So they used to detect like that, and they used the pyramids for that purpose. Even the African plain, African tribe, Dojon, they used to know things that modern science is discovering now. And it's shocking how an African tribe can know such things. That is in Searching for Vedic India, Devamrita Swami Maharaj's book. You can read it and find out. So, obviously, also the pyramids could not be built by any modern technology. They tried with the latest technology some years ago. They couldn't build a pyramid. So this indicates that ancients were must have been very technologically, much more technologically advanced than us. And also they understood the sky, and they understood many things that we don't even understand these days. Actually, society has devolved rather than evolved. If you look at us, we have become so unintelligent that we are destroying ourselves. We are destroying the planet. We are destroying the species. Basically, there was something like 100 species lost every day or something like that because of deforestation, especially in Amazon forests. They're chopping trees, and all the insects and plants and living beings that are living there are becoming extinct every day. And Amazon is one of the biggest centers of biodiversity, you know, on the planet. So they're chopping simply for the market to sell wood, you know, building houses, carpentry, furniture, so many things, making guitars, so many things. Everything goes there. And basically, we're destroying ourselves. So how can that be an advanced civilization? We may have technology of communication and this and that. We may have aeroplanes, but they also had aeroplanes before. Vimanas, it's all written in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in fact, there was a little mosaic on one of these pyramids on the wall. And it was showing clearly, almost like something like a helicopter carved into that mosaic, and almost like a spaceship. And they don't want people to see it because it really indicates an advanced civilization. And one final thing on that point is that the desert today, what was today desert, was actually a lush forest there. Some thousands and thousands of years back, they found evidence that this was actually almost like a jungle there. But because sacrifices were stopped, there was no spirituality performed. People became degraded. And then gradually over thousands of years, there was a climate change and it turned into a desert. Many, many things are there. If you study very carefully what's going on. So, Bhagavatam is definitely giving us insight into higher things, higher knowledge, higher information, which all the ancient cultures have. And one last thing on this, that the Egyptians also believed that there is no death. In fact, in their understanding, the ancient Egyptian understanding is that there is no beginning and no end. Life is eternal. That was their understanding as well. I think Nandanandana Prabhupada's disciple, he quotes in one of his books, proof of Vedic culture's global existence, that there was an inscription of 213 on one of the pyramids. That verse was inscribed. It was inscribed on one of the pyramids, that verse. It's in the book, you can read that. So, in conclusion, how do we understand the Bhagavatam? We study very carefully, Shravanam. We think very carefully about what is being presented there. We perform devotional service, we chant, we follow the four regulative principles. And then what looks strange at first sight, it will become logical, and then gradually it will become an experience that actually these verses indicating a reality that was not part of my worldview or not even part of my experience initially. So this Krishna consciousness movement is not a static religion, but this is actually a scientific movement for re-spiritualization of society. And re-spiritualization means that you gain the experience. It begins with some faith, Shraddha, but behind faith there is Sadhu Sangha, there is Bhajana Kriya, there is Anartha Nivritti Nishta. You become fixed in serving. Ruchi, you develop spiritual taste. Asakti, you become attached to Krishna. Bhav, you develop a first glimpse into your spiritual identity, and then Prema, full-blown love. So, it may take time, but this is not cheap also. And of course, we remain on the path. We remain on the path, although it takes a long time. I've been practicing about 17 years. And I haven't seen Krishna face to face. I have not seen. But I know Krishna is there. Because by serving Krishna, I experience how Krishna reciprocates in varieties of ways with me. Both chastising and kind. It's not always kind. Sometimes everyone likes to say how God reciprocated with them when they received some money or when they got some kind of blessing or something. No, Krishna chastises me like anything, you know. And still I know this is Him. So I haven't seen Krishna, but I know He's there. And also, the more we progress, we will be able to see the hand of Krishna behind all the events that are manifesting. One time, one guy on book distribution, I don't know, was he testing me or what? He was like probing me. He said, "Have you seen Krishna?" You know, he asked me like that. "Have you seen Krishna?" He asked me like this, you know, in a vicious way. And he was expecting that I'll tell him, no, I haven't seen. But I told him, yes, I'm seeing Krishna all the time. He was bewildered. How do you see Krishna? I said to him, I'm seeing Krishna now. He's testing me through you. And also we see Krishna in the form of the deity. Krishna, the deity, is so merciful that even after Krishna finishes his lila and departs from our vision, he remains in the form of deity. So the deity is even more merciful than Krishna because he remains for thousands of generations to give us darshan. And the holy name is even more merciful than the deity. Because what did Maharaj say? You can take the holy name in the shower and the toilet. You can't take the deity there. But you can take the holy name. So in this way, you see in Krishna in the form of the holy name. You see in Krishna in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. You see in Krishna in the form of the deities. You see in Krishna in the form of prasadam. And you are seeing Krishna's hand behind the arrangement of your life. So in this way, that keeps us going. We may not have the full-blown experience of Krishna, but that keeps us going. This higher taste is there. That ecstasy is there. That you did not find in the material world. And this is evidently much superior than what you experienced before. So, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki! Any comments or questions? Yes, Jai Jagannath Prabhu.
Sometimes we see scientists say, show close-up photos of planets like the moon, and you see that there's nothing on the moon. So can you explain that?
They are not showing you the moon. They cheated that they went to the moon. So, there is a movie on BBC. It's BBC London. It's directly showing it was filmed, you know. And I believe the director was Stanley Kubrick. He left his body a few years ago and he said, I hope God will forgive me for this. But of course, in private he was saying this. So somehow that information sneaked out. I hope God will forgive me. They shot the movie somewhere in a studio in London, apparently, and some of the parts in Arizona desert. So, and Prabhupada gives another example. He says, even if they landed on the moon, which he firmly says they didn't, but he says even hypothetically, even if they landed on the moon, and imagine they land on Earth in the desert, and they walk around for thousands and thousands of miles, it's just sand, they may conclude the whole Earth is desert, even if that happened. So, but actually, the moon is not explained to be a desert. It's like a heavenly planet. Lush vegetation is there. So they haven't gone to the moon, and it's simply manipulation. And now they're speaking, we'll go to Mars. It's, in fact, there are people who already paid $100,000 to Richard Branson for a ticket to Mars, one-way ticket to Mars. So he created some cosmic ship to fly them, but then it exploded recently. He was doing tests and it exploded. It was all over the news. So he's now so depressed that his spaceship didn't work out. He's trying to make new one now. I mean, these are demoniac things, you know. Let's go to another planet. Prabhupada said you cannot go to another planet like this. You have to become qualified. You know. So you can't even go sometimes to another country here. You know, they reject your visa. What to speak of going to another planet? You know? So it's all big shows that are going on. For keeping the ignorant mass people peaceful, and that we are doing something important. And I heard this, actually it was documentary, so Don't worry, guys. When we destroy the planet, we'll fly you out to another planet. Hopefully, by then, we'll find another suitable planet. And we'll just fly you out there. And I saw some documentary they were showing. If the heat increases of the sun, so we will take some spacecraft in orbit, and that spacecraft will, what was it? I can't even remember what. We will tie some kind of a big mass, something there, and the spacecraft will flow it into the orbit of the planet, and it will move it a little bit so the heat can decrease. Things like that they're thinking. Serious. There is whole scientific movies made like that. Yeah, that we can actually save the planet for some more thousands of years. If the heat is increased, we can just push it a little bit backwards from its current orbit. And then it will become a little cooler. But what if you push it too much, you know? It will become fully ice, everything. And anyways, it's just childish games. The real business of human being is to understand who is the boss. Like I told you, it shows that there is a control. The law of thermodynamics means if there is an order, gradually it decreases. That's our experience in the world. But we see a constant control. The laws are functioning all the time. There is no change of the laws for thousands and thousands of human history. So that means there is someone in charge. Hare Krishna. Oh, question, okay. The question is, how do you differentiate between more advanced devotees and not so advanced devotees? More advanced devotees, is that it?
No. What's the determining factor that determines why some devotees become very advanced devotees,
okay.
And some devotees just...
What's the determining factor? What is the method that produces pure devotees, and what causes damage if some people don't become pure devotees? Yeah. Thank you. Well, the answer could be answered in just one line. If we perform some offenses, especially offending devotees, if we're harsh towards other devotees, that will block us very seriously. If we are kind to the devotees and we may have some other weaknesses, then we still will progress, but of course it will be much slower. But the most important thing is to treat devotees with respect and kindness and affection, and have some compassion for the jivas, jiva doya, and Vaishnava seva. So if we do that while chanting the holy name, these are the three pillars of spirituality: serving Vaishnavas, compassion for the living entities, and chanting sincerely the holy name. Then this is the engine for progress. But if we make offenses, if we back chat about some devotees, you know, like chatting about back chatting, you know, like you talking behind the back of someone about them, or even in the face, sometimes we may be rude, condescending to someone, these are certainly dampers. They will dampen your devotion. So, yeah, from my experience, this is the most dangerous thing. And of course, if one sticks to the four regulative principles and follows the rest of the simple practices, chanting, reading the Bhagavatam, doing service, then certainly you'll progress. It takes time, but it is not depending on our eagerness, depending on our sincerity, it can be very fast. Within a few years, one can make very serious advancement. And how will you know that? You will know because you will see how you have changed from who you were to who you are today. You will see how attached you are becoming to the process, to the holy name, to serving devotees. These are different indicators. And you're becoming more and more Krishna conscious. This is the key element. You're thinking, if I do this, will I please Krishna? So the more you start to see the world through Krishna's eyes, the more that's indication of advancement. If I do this, will Krishna be pleased and take ourselves out of the center? So this is an indication. Because in the initial neophyte level, we are putting ourselves at the center, and Krishna is not in the center so much. He's kind of on the periphery somewhere. But the more one advances, he always thinks, if I do this, will I please Krishna? So when you fall in love with someone, you're thinking, how will I please my lover? What should I do? If you're really in love with someone, what should I do to please my beloved? And Deva Amrita Maharaj said something very interesting, that pure devotees distinguished from intermediate, I mean, they're all pure devotees, but they're distinguished, the more advanced devotees are distinguished from intermediate and beginners, because even the beginners and the intermediate devotees may have like thinking, okay, what will please Krishna? That may be there to some degree. But the most advanced devotees, the most advanced devotees think, okay, there is A, B, C, D, E, G, whatever. What of these will please Krishna the most? Yeah. And then one studies, okay, this will please Krishna the most, then I'll do that. Okay. So it requires some analysis. Hare Krishna. One last question. Yes, Mataji? Just said the same thing in a different way. Because to determine one's attachment and faith means you're analyzing what will please Krishna the most. You know? So thank you. Yeah. Yeah. The basis is faith. One has a strong faith and has knowledge about reality. Knowledge about Krishna. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki, Nandi Gauri Vaishnava Vrinda ki, Gaur Premanandi.